It is Monday, August 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and Bangladesh agree to cooperate to fight terrorism. The United States condemns clashes in Syria between Turkish and U.S. allied Kurdish forces. And France is rocked by debate over how women should dress at the beach. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry traveled to Bangladesh Monday for talks with officials on fighting terrorism, as well as discussions on other matters. I'm joined by VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman, who's traveling with Secretary Kerry. Steve, Secretary Kerry met with Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. What did they conclude about the effort to battle extremists, particularly Islamic State?
Well, according to Secretary Kerry, Sheikh Hasina, the prime minister, was very keen for closer cooperation with the United States, and they have taken several unspecified measures to have closer cooperation among intelligence and law enforcement authorities in Washington and Dhaka to combat violent extremism.
Did Secretary Kerry talk with reporters afterwards, you know, about efforts to crack down on terrorism in Bangladesh?
Well, he did take a couple of questions from the media after he delivered remarks at the Edward Kennedy Center in Dhaka. Those remarks were, as they say, wide-ranging, but he did touch on this issue, and we put a question to him about whether there would be specific measures, and he answered in the affirmative. He also denied what analysts have been saying, which is that the Bangladeshi government has its head in the sand when it comes to acknowledging that there are outside influences and contacts from groups such as Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State with militants inside Bangladesh. And he said Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and other ministers did not protest that assertion when he put it forward, that there is at least one group in South Asia which has contacts with Islamic State. However, the Reuters news agency contacted Bangladesh's home minister, who said he, in the meeting, did bluntly say that there was no linkage between the homegrown militants and groups such as Islamic State. So a bit of a contradiction there from the U.S. and Bangladeshi side about the characterization of those meetings today.
And what about the issue of human rights? Bangladesh is a country where, in recent months, bloggers and other activists have been killed by extremists.
Yes, the secretary, in his remarks, did make reference to that, saying that in the fight against terrorism, we need to uphold the values of democracy. But he did not specifically criticize, at least in public, the Bangladeshi government on those issues, although a group of UN experts last week came out with a statement where they called for lifting the death penalty in a retrial of a Jamaat Islami leader. There is a widespread perception among human rights activists that these rights are being violated in Bangladesh, and that the Sheikh Hasina government is using the fight against terrorism to go after political enemies to some degree.
Well, now, Secretary Kerry also met with opposition leader Khalid Azia. How did those talks go?
Former Prime Minister Khalid Azia leads the largest opposition party in Bangladesh. However, it boycotted the most recent national election and has no members in parliament at present, but it is a potent force in Bangladeshi politics. Khalid Azia and Sheikh Hasina are known as the battling Begums. This is a fierce political rivalry between these two women, which has gone back for decades. And it has just polarized Bangladeshi politics for many, many years. So in the eyes of most observers, it was prudent for Secretary Kerry to hold this meeting with Khalid Azia, which did occur at the U.S. Embassy in the afternoon.
All right. Thanks very much, Steve. That's VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman. Well, joining me now by phone is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, let's stick with that conversation about terrorism. Out of the UK, the Home Affairs Committee there, using very strong language today, saying that social media and digital media, including Facebook, Twitter, and Google, are, quote-unquote, consciously failing to stop social media terrorism. Now, this is something we've discussed on the show in the past, how terrorist groups like ISIS are using social media very adeptly to recruit. And so the Home Affairs Committee has come out today with these very strong words about this. And we'll see now if the social media companies react. In the past, as these claims have been levied against them here in the U.S., saying they weren't doing enough, they've come out and said, well, we're going to cut down on the accounts that these terrorist organizations have. We're going to try to ban them more and restrict what they can say and what they can do. So we'll see what comes of that from the U.K. Another story that we've talked about in the show in the past is Facebook and how they determine what people see as trending stories. And they've announced today that they are removing humans from that process. Now, this is something we've speculated about and others have speculated on, saying that once people kind of get the system down, Facebook can remove them and just have it be computerized. And it looks like that is the case now. Facebook, of course, faced some issues of accusations of bias, saying that they were not promoting news from conservative websites. So it remains to be seen whether this will be a step towards maybe making their trending topics more subjective or if it's going to address any of those claims that were made. And then sticking with Facebook, CEO Mark Zuckerberg is at the Vatican today where he met with Pope Francis, and he gave him an unusual gift, certainly an unusual gift for a pope to get, and that was a drone. there is a little backstory to this, and that's that this is a replica of the drone or the model of the drone that Facebook plans to use to get more people in rural areas internet access. What they plan to do is use these drones and, I guess, fly them over rural areas as hotspots. So there is kind of a message behind that saying to the Pope, well, we're trying to expand access for some of the poorest people in the world. So, but it was a photo op that Mark Zuckerberg posted on his Facebook page, him and Pope Francis there shaking hands at the Vatican.
Yeah, there might be some drones over the Vatican. Well, thanks very much. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Some of the top stories trending. Suspended Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff addresses the Senate in her impeachment trial. A suicide attack in Yemen's city of Aden kills at least 45 people. The chief of the UN asked Gabon candidates not to claim wins before the results. And the FBI says U.S. state election systems were likely breached by foreign hackers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The International Diabetes Foundation predicts that 1 in 10 people will have diabetes by 2040. Treatment for diabetes can include 1 or 2 painful injections of the hormone insulin every day. Scientists at Niagara University say they've developed an ideal transport system that can withstand some of the harsh environments of the human body and effectively deliver insulin where it needs to go without the need for those painful shots. The insulin is contained in a small capsule made of naturally produced lipid molecules or fatty acids. The researchers found the capsules can travel undamaged through the digestive system, and then cells in the bloodstream take them in and release the insulin. The researchers presented their findings at the 252nd National Meeting and Exposition of the American Chemical Society in Philadelphia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, human rights violations in North Korean prison camps. The United States said Monday clashes in Syria between Turkish forces and units affiliated with a U.S.-supported Kurdish-led alliance are not acceptable and is calling on all sides to stand down immediately. The Turkish military, along with its Syrian rebel allies, is in the sixth day of a campaign designed to drive U.S.-allied Kurdish forces and Islamic State militants out of Jarablus, which borders Turkey. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales tells International Edition's Victor Beattie the Turkish incursion could weaken the Kurds as one of the most effective fighting forces confronting the Syrian government and Islamic State.
The people that the Turks are most concerned about are members of the Syrian Democratic Force and their militia, the People's Protection Units, known as the YPG. They're reasonably closely connected to the PKK, which is a fairly radical Turkish nationalist group based essentially in Turkey. So what's happening is that the Turks have gone after this group, which has been the most effective force fighting Islamic State on the ground. The danger is it's going to detract attention from Islamic State, weakening the Kurds and their capacity to take on Islamic State, and probably not really achieving a hell of a lot from the point of view of the Turks.
The Syrian Democratic Forces, as you know, is backed by the U.S., recently captured a key IS stronghold called Manbij, and apparently the Turks are aimed at taking Manbij.
Well, this is somewhere where, and I'm not sure the extent to which the U.S. and the Turks are agreed on this, but Mr. Biden came out the other day and essentially saying that the Kurds had to back away from Manbij because it's on the wrong side of the Euphrates River.
Turkey's thrust is the result of what, all these suicide bombings in Turkey?
Erdogan decided about a year and a half ago, when he had a very bad electoral result, to create essentially a domestic security issue with the Kurds and started picking on the Kurds. And it's sort of snowballed from there. And so you've had problems with the PKK coming in from Iraq into Turkey. You've had Islamic State coming into Turkey and making attacks. And so, yes, it is to an extent a response to that, but it's perhaps more important an attempt to prevent the Kurds in Syria from forming a solid geographic bloc. Because up until now, they've been scattered all over the northern part of Syria without any real geographic contiguity.
Mr. Erdogan Sunday vowed to devote equal energy in combating both Islamic State jihadists and the Syrian Kurdish fighters. Will that be possible?
Probably not. I think he's starting to respond to pressure from the U.S. and others to reduce his tolerance, if not support, for Islamic State and other extremist groups. He may be forced to take action given the bombings that you've mentioned, but I think really his main focus is to stop the Kurds, because he's concerned about the contagion effect that the Kurds in Turkey will see the Kurds in Syria, with whom they have close ties, doing well, forming a sort of a government. They've got an area called Rojava, which is being run almost on socialist or communist lines, and seems to be doing reasonably well in the context.
Anthony Billingsley warned the Turkish incursion could prolong the Syrian conflict, which erupted in March 2011 and has cost nearly 300,000 lives and has displaced millions of Syrians. A human rights group is beginning to build the case for the eventual prosecution of Kim Jong-un and other North Korean leaders for crimes against humanity by detailing information about thousands of individuals who've been sent to political prison camps. The Database Center for North Korean Human Rights has published a list of political prison detainees, staff, and victims of enforced disappearance, including names, dates of incarceration, alleged crimes, and the locations of camps still in operation. I spoke with VOA North Asia correspondent Brian Patton in Seoul.
It has been a problem for decades, but since 2014, when the United Nations published an intensive investigative report documenting systematic and widespread and longstanding human rights abuses in North Korea, that report got the notice of the international community. And since then, the interest has been much greater. You have seen the United Nations itself, the General Assembly, vote to refer North Korea to the International Human Rights Court on charges of crimes against humanity. You've had South Korea pass a human rights bill that is tracking human rights abuses in North Korea. You have the U.S. impose additional sanctions in addition to the sanctions that have been imposed on North Korea for its nuclear program. The U.S. has imposed additional sanctions for human rights violations and have also linked the existing sanctions to improvements to the human rights situation. So there's a lot of sudden interest from the international community on this issue. So this organization is trying to kind of reinforce the study that's been done. And they're also thinking for long-term, someday in the future when the situation changes in North Korea, they want to be prepared with evidence in hand.
And what about the conditions at these prisons? You know, I'm assuming that they've spoken to defectors or, how do they get the information as to know what the conditions at these camps are like?
This catalog, this list of names and all of the investigations, both from the UN report in 2014 and the reports that have been done by this group, the Database Center for North Korean Human Rights, they're all based on interviews with North Korean defectors. And that's how they get it. And what they have found out were the extensive list of human rights violations that happen in North Korea center around these prison camps. And so in these prison camps, people are stripped of all their human rights. There's forced labor, there's extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances, arbitrary arrests, beatings, forced starvation, sexual assault, forced labor, torture. That's some of the list.
One of the most terrible things about the prison system in North Korea is that someone can be sent to prison not just because they themselves, that person has done something, but it could be the family member or even a friend of someone who's been accused. They will send them as well.
Right, and they've documented many cases of families who have been sent. They have documented cases of children who have been sent. Well, guilt by association. You get charged with guilt by association.
That's VOA North Asia correspondent Brian Patton. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election right here on VOA.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. France's burkini ban, imposed by about 30 coastal towns, has the blessing of many high-level officials, but the debate is far from over. International Edition's Lori London talked about it with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field.
According to a survey which was done by the French newspaper Le Figaro, 64% of French people are in favor of a ban on women wearing the burkini at the beach. 30% are indifferent.
What do they think that will achieve?
The nugget in all of this is that at the moment France is going through a real crisis. It's had these terror attacks. It's had now for really about 15, 20 years had to address the fact that there are French people who are not predominantly Christian and not Catholic. This is a Catholic country. It is Catholic to its roots. Train station, holidays, they're all Catholic. Now, they have to deal with the fact that a large portion of their population are Muslim, and they're having trouble with that. They really are. So at the moment, when all of this comes together, you've got your economic downturn, you've got problems of identity, something that stands out like a burkini, just they don't know how to react. It gets them to their core of, are we going to be a multicultural society, or are we going to try and force these people to assimilate? But of course, you're talking about people who were born here, telling them to assimilate, when in fact they're French. They were born here. They went to the same schools as everybody else. They are at home here, and they have made a decision to follow this particular faith.
Their faith tells them that they should be covered up, so this
well,
is...
Well, some of them say, my faith doesn't tell me this. I have decided I will do it. My faith tells me it's a good thing to do. It doesn't tell me I have to do it, but I choose to do it. Rather, and this is the debate you're starting to hear, but very, very quietly, rather like a nun who has joined a convent decides to wear a habit, and she is allowed to wear that habit when she goes to the beach.
Oh, that's...
And those are also the photographs that have been making their way into newspapers in France in the last week, photos of groups of nuns from the French Riviera wearing their habit, wearing their clothes that are so distinctly religious in the way that the government says, you know, is illegal if it's a Muslim woman wearing it.
Right. Well, of course, you know, across the United States, there is a segment of the population that is afraid, connecting Islam with terrorism, even though we know that the people that commit these atrocities are extremists and not ordinary Muslims just practicing their religion. But I know that the string of terrorist attacks that have been happening in France, of course, have raised a lot of fear and anger and suspicion, I would imagine.
Oh, an immense amount of suspicion. And despite the fact that there is a very large number across the country of, if you almost like, secular Muslims who came out right straight after all these attacks and said, you know, we condemn this. This is not done in the name of Islam. This is not what Islam stands for. They just don't get heard, or people are just so taken by the fact that this used to be a safe country and now it's not safe. And that, if you like, just wipes away any type of message that members of the Muslim community are saying, you know, that this is not done in their name.
That's Paris-based journalist Catherine Fields speaking to International Edition's Lori London. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After recent meetings in Nairobi with foreign ministers of a number of regional partners, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that a regional protection force authorized by the United Nations Security Council is necessary to protect civilians in South Sudan's capital of Juba and to help facilitate the implementation of a peace accord reached by South Sudan's warring factions last year. The Security Council approved the Regional Protection Force within the United Nations mission in South Sudan on August 12th, after violence broke out in and around the capital between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and former First Vice President Riek Machar. During the height of the July 7th to 11th violence, soldiers from both sides committed heinous crimes, including rape, murder, and wanton destruction of property. Government forces also attacked UN protection of civilian sites and a UN compound. Since 2013, when the conflict first started in South Sudan, the country has been ravaged, with thousands of people killed and over 2 million driven from their homes. Secretary Kerry noted that all the ministers who met in Nairobi agreed on the need for the deployment of the up to 4,000-member protection force authorized by the UN Security Council. Secretary Kerry emphasized that the force does not challenge the sovereignty of the country. It has, he said, a very clear mandate to protect people for their access, their freedom of movement, and their ability to remain free from attack or ambush from any source whatsoever. The hope is, he said, that the protection force will restore stability, will help the country to move faster to reconcile, will help by its presence alone provide assurance and confidence to people about the future. Mr. Kerry announced that the United States, which is the largest donor of humanitarian relief to the people of South Sudan, will give an additional $138 million toward that effort, bringing its total contribution to more than $1.7 billion. But the overwhelming need in the country, Mr. Kerry said, is to reinvigorate an inclusive political process and to implement the reforms that are set out in the peace agreement. Secretary of State Kerry urged the people of South Sudan to respect their countrymen as equal under the law and to demand that their leadership stop this fighting on an ethnic basis and get to the business of running the country in a responsible and inclusive way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.